I'd better do that first. Ruth just asked me to be sure and get in a commercial and say that the Poetry Center is very glad to have you all here and have Mr. Schwartz to read for us. And so I made sure to mention the Poetry Center. As is this thing working? I have a kind of vague impression it isn't.
It is.
The last poet I introduced was Carl Sandburg. It's quite a contrast. And, of course, you always say it gives me great pleasure. It does, you know. It gave me great pleasure to introduce Carl Sandburg. But it really does, it is very pleasurable to introduce Delmore. If for no other reason than that all the years in which we've been making modern literature, we have never met. And so we had dinner tonight and we had a most enjoyable meeting and I was given great pleasure. Delmore Schwartz has never belonged to a generation. I belong to several. He's very lucky. He came in a low period of American poetry, and he would have shone brilliantly anyway, but he shone like that nova, you know, that the Chinese have recorded, I think, in 3000 BC or something. He showed with spectacular brilliance in his first book, and I, for one, have never forgotten its impact on us before the war. And that promise, which so often is never fulfilled, has been fulfilled in his successive books. The first book was called, had one of the more remarkable titles in English literature, I think, was called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. He then wrote a long poem called Shenandoah, and then Vaudeville for a Princess, and then a book that I must say I had never read called Summer Knowledge. I don't know why. But I have always been impressed by the steady growth of a very serious and intellectually responsible poetry of a kind that I suppose is really rare in America. It's not flashy, and that's what I meant by saying it didn't belong to a generation, lost or found or beat or cool or anything else. It has none of those qualities. It has a complexity and a profundity and an integrity that I think is really very rare. It's all too easy to say that someone is unique in American poetry, but I think Delmore Schwartz is. I don't know of another poet who resembles him at all, and that is all to his credit. And once again, it's a great pleasure. Delmore Schwartz.
I've been reading my poems for the last 2 days, and I decided that perhaps I could be more charitable to my audience if I changed some of the poems. I've read some of them 3 times in the last 4 days. So I'd like to begin with poem which I haven't read, which is the Bible story of Abraham, and it's called Abraham. I was a mere boy in a stonecutter's shop when, early one evening, my raised hand was halted and the soundless voice said, "Depart from your father and your country and the things to which you are accustomed. Go now into a country unknown and strange. I will make of your children a great nation. Your generations will haunt every generation of all the nations. They will be like the stars at midnight, like the sand of the sea. Then I looked up at the infinite sky, star-pointing and silent, and it was then, on that evening, that I became a man. That evening was my manhood's birthday. I went then to Egypt, the greatest of nations. There I encountered the Pharaoh who built the tombs, great public buildings, many theaters and seashore villas, and my wife's beauty was such that, fearing his power and his lust, I called her my sister, a girl neither for him nor for me, and soon was fugitive, a nomad again, living alone with my sister, becoming very rich in all but children, in herds, in possessions. The herds continually increased my possessions through prodigies of progeny. From time to time, in the afternoon's reverie, in the late sunlight, or the cool of the evening, I call to mind the protracted vanity of that promise which had called me forth from my father's house unwillingly into the last strangeness of Egypt and the childless desert. Then Sarah gave me her handmaid, a young girl, that I might at least, at last, have children by another. And later, when a great deal else had occurred, I put away Hagar with the utmost remorse, because the child was the cause of so much rivalry and jealousy. At last, when all this had passed, or when the promise seemed the puzzled parts of a dream, when we were worn out and patient in all things, the stranger came, suave and elegant, a messenger who renewed the promise, making Sarah burst out laughing hysterically. But the boy was born and grew, and I saw what I had known, I knew what I had seen, for he possessed his mother's beauty and his father's humility, and was not marked and marred by her sour irony and my endless anxiety. Then the angel returned, asking that I surrender my son as a lamb to show that humility still lived in me and was not altered by age and prosperity. I said nothing, shocked and passive. Then I said, but to myself alone, this was to be expected. These promises are never unequivocal or unambiguous. In this, as in all things which I desired the most, I have had great riches and great beauty. I cannot expect perfection of every wish. And if I deny the command, who knows what will happen? His life was forgiven and given back to me. His children and their children are an endless nation dispersed on every coast, and I am not gratified nor astonished. It has never been otherwise. Exiled, wandering, dumbfounded by riches, estranged among strangers, dismayed by the infinite sky, and alien to myself until at last the cast of the last alienation, the angel of death comes to make the alienated and indestructible one a part of this famous society. Next I'd like to read another poem based on the Bible and on Abraham's grandson Jacob. Jacob, all was as it is before the beginning began, before we were bared to the cold. cold air before pride, fullness of bread, abundance of idleness. No one has ever told me, but now I know. Love is unjust, justice is loveless. So, as it was to become, it was in the black womb's ignorance, coiled and bound under the mother's heart. There in the womb we wrestled and writhed, hurt each other, long before each was other and apart, for we breathed. Who then committed greed, impersonation, usurpation? So, in the coming forth, in the noose and torment of birth, Esau went first. He was red all over. I followed him clutching his heel, and we were named. Esau, the one of the vivid coat. Jacob, the one who clutches the heel of the one who has a vivid coat. The names were true as the deceptive reality into which we were thrown, for I did not know what clutching was, nor had I known, would I have known whose heel I clutched, my brother's or my own. So the world we entered then and thus was one, in which the second must be second, that the first may be first. The world of precedence, order, other, under, and above, the darkness, sweetness, confusion, and unity of love. How the truth of our names became, as we grew more true, growing like truth. How could it be otherwise? For truth abides, hidden in the future, in the ambush of the marvelous, unknown and monstrous, at the very heart of surprise. The gift was mine, the gift was eminence, the gift, like every gift, was guilt. The guilt began in the darkness and dark mystery where all begins. The mystery of the perpetual, invisible fires whence flow the very beasts and woods where, with what happiness, what innocence, Esau, my brother, hunted, cantering like the horses of summer, and sleeping when he returned the sleep of winter farms. Spontaneous and blessed, like energy itself, sleeping or awake, until the hour when the angels struck. So it was, so. O angel of the unspeakable, why must a gift be guilt and hurt the gifted one? O angel of the unspeakable power of powers, locking my reins, my arms, my heart all night, so that my body was burdened as if with the load of all stones. Dost thou remember what, in the darkness, I cried during the desperation in which I died the last death of hope and the little deaths of the heart, wrestling and writhing between two rivers? On one bank, Esau awaited me like a river slept beneath me once more. Hast thou not seen, I cried aloud, to the unspeakable, Esau, my brother, his handsome hunting heart upon a horse? How should it seem so strange that I should win, since victory was my gift, unjust, like every gift, as something neither deserved nor gained by toil? How else could it be gift and given? Favor, favored, favorite, gold hair, great strength, Esau was very tall, possessed by the supple grace of the sea waves breaking. Now, Joseph is, as I was, in Egypt's pit, in that accustomed depth and isolated height, the solitude of eminence, the exiled intelligence which separated me, even as it created me, estranged and unloved, gifted and detested, denied the love of the servants and the dogs. Joseph, a stranger in Egypt, may only know what I have known, my gifts, my victory, my guilt. For Egypt is a country like a gift. The gift is loved, but not the gifted one. The coat of many colors is much admired by everyone, but he who wears the coat is not made warm. Why should the gift be the cause of pain, O thou unspeakable? Must the vivid coat of eminence elect the favored favorite as scapegoat or turncoat? Exile a fugitive, loved of mother and God, and by all others shunned in fear or contempt. I knew what it was when Joseph became my favorite, knew the sympathy of the long experience of the unasked for gift, knew the nature of love. How many colors can a coat have? What should we wish if we could choose? What should I desire? Not to have loved my son, the best of sons, rejected the choice of love? Or should he have concealed the self I loved? Above all others, wearing the coat which is customary, the coats his brothers wore. To how many coats can a color give vividness? How can the heart know love and not love one the more? Love is unjust. Justice is loveless. Now I would like to read three poems about music, one of which I tried for the first time this afternoon. And a solemn music. Let the musicians begin. Let every instrument awaken and instruct us in love's willing river and love's dear discipline. We wait, silent, in consent, and in the penance of patience, awaiting the serene exaltation, which is the liberation and conclusion of expiation. Now may the chief musician say, lust and emulation have dwelt among us like barbarous kings, have conquered us, have inhabited our hearts, devoured and ravished with the savage greed and avarice of fire, the substance of pity and compassion. Now may all the players play, the river of the morning of the river, flow out of the splendor of the tenderness of surrender. Now may the chief musician say, nothing is more important than summer. And now the entire choir shall chant, how often the astonished heart, beholding the laurel, remembers the dead, and the enchanted absolute snow's kingdom, sleep's dominion. Then shall the chief musician declare, the phoenix is the meaning of the fruit, until the dream is knowledge and knowledge is a dream. And then once again the entire choir shall cry in passionate unity, singing and celebrating love and love's victory, ascending and descending the heights of ascent, climbing and chanting triumphantly, before the morning was, you were, before the snow shone and the light sang, and the stone abiding rode the fullness or endured the emptiness, you were alone. Darkling summer, ominous dusk, rumorous rain, a tattering of rain, and then the rain of pour and pouring down and down. After the westward gathered the filming gown of gray and clouding weakness, and in the main the light's glory and the day's splendor, gold and vain, vivid, more and more vivid, scarred, lucid and more luminous, there came a splatter, a prattle, a blowing rain, and soon the hour was musical and rumorous, a softness of a dripping lip, the isolated houses, a gaunt, gray, somber softness, licked the glass of hours. Again, after a catbird squeaked in the special silence and clouding vagueness fogged the window pane and gathered blackness and overcast. The mane of light's story and light's glory surrendered and ended. A pebble, a ringing on the pane, a blowing and a blowing in, tied to the blue and cold moods of the great blue bay, and slates of gray came down upon the land's great sea, the body of this day. Hardly an atom of silence amid the roar allowed the voice to form appeal, to call. By kindle light we thought we saw the bronze of four. And the longest of the three poems about music, Vivaldi. In the dark church of music, which never is of land or sea alone, but blooms within the air inside the mind, patterns in motion and action, successions of processionals, moving with the majesty of certainty, to part the unparted curtains, to bring the chandeliers into the saraband of courtiers who have bowed and curtsied, turned somersaults in circuses, climbed masts and towers, or dived as from a glittering tower toward a glistening lake, springing, daring and assured, fearless and precise, to find in the darkness the dark church which music is. This is what music is. It has no meaning and is possessed by all meaning. For music says, remorse, here is the scar of healing. Here is a window, curiosity. And here, O sensuality, a sofa. Behold for ambition's purposeless energy, mountains rising beyond mountains more tense and steep than any known before. Devout, the processional, having a solemn majesty, though childlike acrobats like flowers decorate with flourishes and entrechats for the passage to success. As queens, serene, crowned by poise, slowly are drawn cars by dragons domesticated in the last wars. It is uttered fully and yet freshly, newly and uniquely, uniquely and newly, freshly yet fully uttered again. Oh, clear soprano like the morning peal of the bluebells, oh, the watercolors of the early morning, An amore and vivace, dancing, prancing, galloping, rollicking. This is a surrender to the splendor of beings becoming and being. Here are all the flowers and the images of faces as flowers of fear and hope, longing and despair. Here is the hour of the new blue flower, dissolved, consumed in this being which is the being of being. So we are to be contained, so we are to be consumed. The iron flower of the flute possesses morning's intuition. The cellist is a Gautama Buddha, curved like an almond. Noah conducts the ark of all the dark beauty. The first violinist is Saint Francis of Assisi, blessing the trees, the cats, the birds, calling to them and calling them his brothers and his sisters. The full orchestra responds to the virtuoso's cadenza. Love is the dark secret of everything. Love is the open secret of everything, an open secret useless as the blue. Music is not water, but it moves like water. It is not fire, but it soars as warm as the sun. It is not rock, it is not fountain, but rock and fountain, clock and mountain, abide within it, bound together, in radiance pulsing, vibrating and reverberating, dominating the domination of the weather. The music flowing as a river and a city ringed about a river, and a river mastered by a city, has destiny's look. the dictates of the heart, and the heart's dictatorship must submit to the score of the lyre, gentle like all fire, to ashen, falling failure. The music, although unseen, is hushed no more nor less than snows fall, slowly falling after being possessed by the dynasty of destiny. And then, is suddenly more self-delighting than a troop of birds in swinging, singing, ringing, curving flight, in curves and swerves, dipping and perching, perching and soaring, sailing and gliding. The music declares, is this what you want? Is this the good news for which you have been here convened? To be, to become, and to participate in the sweet congress of serene attention? Silent, attentive, motionless, waiting, save for the heart clutching itself and the hushed breathing. A sudden cough sticks in the enchantments of dancing. The answered question is our being, our presence, our surrender. Consciousness has consented, is consumed, has surrendered to hear only the players playing. Consciousness has become only and purely listening. The vivid world has been barred, the press of desire shut out. All lights are dim, save for the swan unseen, the port and arc of Panurge, sailing the darkness. All desire consumed except the desire of this being, presence of this being, the being of this presence, this being, this is the being the dream strives for and passion presses towards, above the clouds and the shrouds, rising like a plane forever, far from the world of Caesar and Venus, calculation and sensuality, ratiocination and frustration. This is the dark city of the hidden innermost wish, the motion beyond emotion, the power beyond and free of power. This is the immortality of mortality. This is supreme consciousness. This is the grasped reality of reality, moving forward now and forever. Now, I'd like to read several poems about authors and about authorship and about poetry. Each of the first two poems are based, the first three are based upon the journals and letters of the author in question. Stern, the reference is, of course, to Lawrence Stern. Held in bondage day and night by dear my Lord Falkenberg, with whom I dined at the Boar's Head. There the whole pandemonium assembled supped. Have just been eating chicken, weeping. Seated and weeping, the tears fall over it. A bitter sauce. I have doubled the Cape of Good Hope. I have looked in Yarrick's face. I wish I were in Arno's Vale, for here at Coxhole days are princely, a land of plenty, and I dine on trout, on venison, and on wild fowl. Yet, as I eat my strawberries, for want of you I am as melancholy as a cat. I have a cat now, sits beside me, quietly and gravely purrs to my sorrows, gazes at me solemnly, as if he knew the reason of my pain. How soothable the heart is, dear Eliza, supported when it sinks pathetically by a poor beast purring harmoniously. Me, me, poor Yark, harks to an anodyne, dark and sweet as the poppy, fresh and rash as the cock's cold. Love, alas, has fled with thee, whom all night my wakeful eyes, while all day is blind to me, imagine, summon, I lie, standing for dim gates of pitifully. Such is my hope, my vanity, waiting in the great green park most patiently. Next, and companion poem is about Swift. What shall Presto do for pretty prattle to entertain his dears? Sunday, lightning 50 times. This week to Flanders goes the Duke of Ormond. Small hope of him, although he loves me well. All of my hopes now possible, none certain. As my lampoon talked up all over, cried up to the sky, you are an impudent slut to be so positive, though all has gone just as you said it would. Sirrah, write constantly. Don't I write every day and sometimes twice? Stella writes like an emperor. Sirrah, I am surprised forever by myself or by the others. Dee, an angel child, stupid in me, stupid or innocent, astonished by the gush of vanity, the stone and eyes of pride, yet equally by the least straw or glitter of nobility. Faith, Madam Dingley, what think you of the world to come? Patience is a gay thing. Oh, saucy rogues, patience is better than knowledge. Be gay till I return. Mr. Hawley speaks every kind thing to me. Truly, I do believe, would serve me if I stayed. Called at the coffee house, stayed there a while, coldly conversed with Mr. Addison. All our friendship and dearness now off. Is it not odd? I think he has used me ill. I have as little pleasure as any one in all the world, although I am in full favor with the entire ministry. Nothing gives Presto any dream of happiness but letters now and then from his dearest ones. The pride of power, the pride and pleasure of place and power, are towers and trivial toys which lure me grievously, raging furiously in lunation's infuriation, bursting the Rome in my head, my empire. Gulliver, Gullibo, the Caesars in my heart tell me how all infamy is possible and certain treacheries extremely probable. I must take leave of dearest envy now. Prithee, be merry, patient girls, and love your Presto. I have fed all the trash, and I am weary. Dearest lives, there is peace and quiet with thee, and thee alone. None have leisure here for little things. Farewell again, dear rogues, I am never happy but when I think of thee, M.D. Sirrah, I have had enough of courts and ministries. I wish I were once more at Laracor. Faith, do you know each syllable I write? I hold my lips exact for all the world as if I talked a little language with M.D. Yesterday died the Duke of Ormond's daughter. Poor dear, she was with child. She was my favorite pet. Save thee, I hardly knew a being more valuable, more beautiful, of more nobility. I fear the certainty that she was thrown away quite carelessly and merely lacked care. 'Tis clear at any rate that she was very healthy naturally. Our Lord's a puppy. I'll know more of him now that he's lost his only valuable. I hate life when I see it thus exposed to accidents like these. So many thousands birthing the earth with their stupidity, while such as she must die abruptly, pointlessly. Somebody is coming, wants a little place. My heart is set cherry trees by the riverside, my saucy sluts. Farewell, my dearest knight, pretty M.D. Why see a sea that's 10 miles wide, a town on t'other side, ships sailing in the sea, discharging great cannons at M.D.'s and me. I see a great sky, moon, and stars, and all, I am a fool. And the next poem is about the German poet Hölderlin. Now, as before, do you not hear their voices, serene in the midst of their rejoicing, chanting to those who have hopes and make choices, clear as the birds in the thick summer foliage? It is, we are, clearly as if they were us and not us, hidden like the future, distant as the stars, having no more meaning than the fullness of music, chanting from the pure peaks where success, effort, and desire are meaningless, surpassed at last in the joy of joy, chanting at last the blues' last view. It is, this is eternity, eternity is now. And next, a similar poem about Baudelaire. When I fall asleep, and even during sleep, I hear quite distinctly voices speaking whole phrases, commonplace and trivial, having no relation to my affairs. Dear mother, is any time left to us in which to be happy? My debts are immense. My bank account is subject to the court's judgment. I know nothing. I cannot know anything. I have lost the power to make an effort. But now as before, my love for you increases. You are always armed to stone me, always. It is true. It dates from childhood. For the first time in my long life, I am almost happy. My book, almost finished, almost seems good. It will endure a monument to my obsessions, my hatred, my disgust. Debts and quietude persist and weaken me. Satan glides before me, saying sweetly, rest for a day. You can rest and play today. Tonight you will work. When night comes, my mind, terrified by the arrears, bored by sadness, paralyzed by impotence, promises, tomorrow, I will tomorrow. Tomorrow, the same comedy enacts itself with the same resolution, the same weakness. I am sick of this life of furnished rooms. I am sick of having colds, headaches. You know my strange life. Every day brings its quota of wrath. Little know a poet's life, mother. I must write poems, the most fatiguing of occupations. I am sad this morning. Do not reproach me. I write from a cafe near the post office amid the click of billiard balls, the clatter of dishes, the pounding of my heart. I have been asked to write a history of caricature. I have been asked to write a history of sculpture. Shall I write a history of the caricatures, of the sculptures, of you in my heart? Although it costs you countless agony, although you cannot believe it necessary, and doubt that the sum is accurate, please send me money enough for at least 3 weeks. Now I want to be sure that I read at least two poems in which are about children, although they're not children's poems. I am cherry alive, the little girl sang. I am cherry alive, the little girl sang. Each morning I am something new. I am apple, I am plum. I am just as excited as the boys who made the Halloween bang. I am tree, I am cat, I am blossom too. When I like, if I like, I can be someone new. Someone very old, a witch in a zoo. I can be someone else whenever I think who. And I want to be everything sometimes too. And the peach has a pit, and I know that too. And I put it in along with everything. Make the grown-ups laugh whenever I sing. And I sing, it is true, it is untrue. I know, the true is untrue. The peach has a pit, the pit has a peach. And both may be wrong when I sing my song. But I don't tell the grown-ups because it is sad. And I want them to laugh just like I do. Because they grew up and forgot what they knew. And they are sure I will forget it someday too. They're wrong, they're wrong. When I sang my song, I knew I am red, I am gold, I am green, I am blue. I will always be me, I will always be new. The true blue American. Jeremiah Dixon was a true blue American. For he was a little boy who understood America. For he felt that he must think about everything because that's all there is to think about. Knowing immediately the intimacy of truth and comedy, knowing intuitively how a sense of humor was a necessity for one and for all who live in America, thus, natively and naturally, when on an April Sunday in an ice cream parlor, Jeremiah was requested to choose between a chocolate sundae and a banana split, he answered unhesitatingly, having no need to think of it, being a true blue American, determined to continue as he began, rejecting the either-or of Kierkegaard and many another European, refusing to accept alternatives, refusing to believe the choice of between, rejecting selection, denying dilemma, electing absolute affirmation, knowing in his breast the infinite and the gold of the endless frontier, the deathless West. Both! I will have them both, declared this true blue American. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, on an April Sunday, instructed by the great department stores, by the 5 and 10, taught by Christmas, by the circus, by the vulgarity and grandeur of Niagara Falls and the Grand Canyon, tutored by the grandeur, vulgarity, and infinite appetite, gratified and shining in the darkness of the light, on Saturdays at the double bills of the moon pictures, the consummation of the advertisements, the imagination of the light, which is, as it was, the infinite belief and infinite hope of Columbus, Barnum, Edison, and Jeremiah Dixon. The would-be Hungarian. Come, let us meditate upon the fate of a little boy who wished to be Hungarian. Having been moved with his family to a new suburb, having been sent to a new school, the only Catholic school in the new suburb, where all the other children were Hungarian, he felt very sad and separate on the first day. He felt more and more separated and isolated, because all the other boys and girls pitied and were sorry for him, since he was not Hungarian. Hence they pitied and were sorry for him so much they gave him handsome gifts, presents of comic books, marbles, and foreign coins, peppermints and candy, a pistol, and also their devoted sympathy, pity, and friendship, making him sadder still, since now he saw how all Hungarians were very kind and generous, and he was not Hungarian. Hence, he was an immigrant, an alien. He was and he would be forever, no matter what. He could never become Hungarian. Hungarian. Hence, he went home on the first day, bearing his gifts and telling his parents how much he wished to be Hungarian. In anguish, in anger, accusing them of depriving him and misusing him, amusing them, so that he rose to high fury, shouting and accusing them, "Because of you, I'm a stranger, monster, orangutan. Because of you," his hot tears say, "I'm an orangutan and not Hungarian. Worse than to have no bicycle, no shoes." Behold how this poor boy, who wished so passionately to be Hungarian, suffered and knew the fate of being American. Whether on Ellis Island, Plymouth Rock, or in the secret places of the mind and the heart, this is America as poetry and hope. This is the fame, the game, and the names of our fate. This we must suffer, or we must celebrate. And now I'd like to read the... What time do we start? I want to announce
you.
Well, this next poem is, well, I won't say anything about it, I'll just read it. The Fulfillment. "Is it a dream?" I asked, to which my fellow answered with a hoarse voice and dull insistence, "Dream? Is it a dream? What difference does it make or mean? If it is only a dream, it is the dream which we are, dream or the last resort of reality. It is the truth of our minds. We are condemned because this is our consciousness. Where we were, if we were there, serene and shining, each being sang and moved with the sleekness of rivers, united in a choir, many in one, as the spires of flames and fire, flowing and perfected, flourishing and fulfilled forever, rising and falling as the carousel and palace of festival and victory." I was told often enough, my fellows said. You were told too, and you as little believed. Beware of all your desires, you are deceived, as they are deceived and deceptive, urgent and passing. They will be wholly fulfilled, you will be dead. They will be gratified, and you will be dead. In a fixed fascination, wonder-struck, we gazed, marveling at the fulfillment so long desired and praised. Their effort was like dancing, its own pleasure. There all things existed purely in the action of joy, like light, like all of the kinds of light, all in the domination of celebration existed only as the structures of joy. Then, as we gazed in an emotion more exhausting than mountains, then when at last we knew where we had come, it was then that we saw what was lost, as we knew where we had been, or knew where we had been, as we saw all that was lost, and knew for the first time the richness and poverty of what we had been before and were no more, the striving, the suffering, the dear, dark-footed mortality, which we had been and never known, which we had resisted, detested, feared, and denied, the rocks and the flowers and the faces of the needs and the hopes which had given us our reality. And finally, as a kind of summation of some of the things in the other poems, a poem about poetry itself called The Kingdom of Poetry. Poetry is certainly more interesting, more valuable, and certainly more charming than Niagara Falls, the Grand Canyon, the Atlantic Ocean, and other much admired natural phenomena. It is useful as light, and it is as beautiful. It is preposterous precisely, making it possible to say one cannot carry a mountain, but a poem can be carried all over all day. It is monstrous pleasantly, for poetry can say, seriously or in play, poetry is better than hope, for poetry is the patience of hope and all hope's vivid pictures. Poetry is better than excitement. It is far more delightful. Poetry is superior to success and victory. It endures in serene blessedness long after the most fabulous feat like fireworks has mounted and fallen. Poetry is a far more powerful and far more enchanting animal than any wood, jungle, ark, circus, or zoo possesses. For poetry magnifies and heightens reality. Poetry says of reality that if it is magnificent, it is also stupid. For poetry is in a way omnipotent. For reality is various and rich, powerful and vivid, but it is not enough, because it is disorderly and stupid, or only at times and erratically intelligent. For without poetry, reality is speechless or incoherent. It is inchoate, like the pomp and bombast of thunder. Its perorations verge upon the ceaseless oration of the ocean. For reality's glow and glory without poetry fade like the red operas of sunset, the blue rivers and windows of morning. The art of poetry makes it possible to say pandemonium, for poetry is gay, and it is exact, it says. The sunset resembles a bullfight. A sleeping arm feels like soda fizzing. Poetry resurrects the past from the sepulcher, like Lazarus. It transforms a lion into a sphinx and a girl. It gives to a girl the splendor of Latin. It transforms the water into wine in each marriage in Cana of Galilee. For it is true that poetry invented the unicorn, the centaur, and the phoenix. Hence it is true that poetry is an everlasting ark, an omnibus containing, bearing, and begetting all the mind's animals. Whence it is that poetry gave and gives tongue to forgiveness. Therefore, a history of poetry would be a history of joy and a history of the mystery, love. For poetry provides spontaneously, abundantly, and freely the pet names and the diminutives which love requires and without which the mystery of love cannot be mastered. For poetry is like light, and it is light. It shines over all, like the blue sky with the same blue justice. For poetry is the sunlight of consciousness. It is also the soil of the fruits of knowledge and the orchards of being. It shows us the pleasures of the city. It lights up the structures of reality. It is the cause of knowledge and laughter. It sharpens the whistles of the witty. It is like morning and the flutes of morning, chanting and enchanting. It is the birth and rebirth of the first morning forever. Poetry is quick as tigers, clever as cats, vivid as oranges. Nevertheless, it is deathless. It is evergreen and blossom. Long after the pharaohs and cedars have fallen, it shines and endures more than diamonds. This is because poetry is the actuality of possibility. It is the reality of the imagination, the throat of exaltation, possession of possession, the motion of meaning and the meaning of mourning and the mastery of meaning. The praise of poetry is like the clarity of the heights of the mountains. The heights of poetry are like the exaltation of the mountains. Poetry is the consummation of consciousness in the country of the morning. Thank you.